You people are too much. And now for an ancient historical hand-tooled presentation. I have to say, you should probably get out your Blackberries and your computers and tweet this. We have one small reminder for you to add to your to-do lists. Securing planetary survival is on our to-do list. I want to talk a little bit about what John Norquist has called the convenient remedy. The convenient remedy to the inconvenient truth. Or, if you buy my version of it, all four of the inconvenient truths. Some generations are presented with their unique historic challenges. And they have to meet them with some brand new way of doing things or some great enterprise. You know, recovering from 1929 comes to mind. 1944 comes to mind. 1964 comes to mind. Last week when the D-Day anniversary passed, I thought a lot about this. My father was there. My dad was a national hero along with several hundred thousand of his buddies on D-Day. And, that greatest generation was presented with a great international project, you know, to secure freedom. It was very clear to all those who were there that day what they were born to do. And then came more great enterprises. You know, for example, securing civil rights for all was one. And putting humankind on the moon was one. But now most of us in this room probably grew up wondering, so what's our project? What are we going to do? What are we here for? Well, congratulations. You don't get one. You get four. You get four really hard ones. They're all braided together in one strong rope, either in your hands or around your neck or both, because there's not just one emergency. There's not just one inconvenient truth. There are at least four. A perfect storm, it means you're in the room on the right week to work on it. They are at least these. First, global climate change and the associated threat of sea level rise and all the other catastrophes that are expected to be associated with climate change. Second, the incipient post-peak oil era and the need to adjust to a post-carbon world. We think we're up to this. Third, deteriorating public health. Evidence, for example, by the rise of childhood obesity and diabetes, hypertension, heart disease. And then fourth, we'll just call it the wave. They're doing the wave. And that is this unstoppable march of a very long anticipated demographic tide change and its accompanying mismatch between our built physical human habitat and the needs of our households and our businesses. Todd Zimmerman and Laurie Volk have warned us for a long time that was going to happen. And guess what? Andres told me last week or a week before that in 2009, the 20th century finally ended. Just like the 19th century finally ended in 1914. And exactly what Todd and Laurie warned us would need to be done has arrived. Now, the new urbanist practitioners are in a pretty unique spot. At a time when we have this perfect storm of four emergencies, we have enduring, tested, detailed, holistic, artful solutions to address all four emergencies at the same time. We don't do just one thing and expect one benefit from it. We do one thing and expect several benefits from it. We plant street trees, for example. And we call that a carbon reduction strategy. And we call that a walkability strategy, and therefore part of a transportation solution. We call that an economic development tool because of the benefit to the adjacent properties, and so on. We have the solutions that will not come from technological research labs and aren't going to come from well-meaning, but probably oversimplifying friends of ours in the congregations of smart growth, nor from the single-issue specialists in environmental regulation. Now, in the time of a great perfect storm, This is not the moment to descend into a bunch of worried mumbling among ourselves. You made it to Denver. Good. It's not the time to descend into a lot of hand-wringing and squabbling. Now's probably the time to declare victory, because stuff that was fringe material at CNU1 in Alexandria is now mainstream policy and expected as a given, even though not enough people know how to deliver on it. We now have mainstream ideas. You know, at CNU1, we had this astonishing experience of looking around the room at 100 or 150 other people who had seen the same UFO that we had seen. And that was a brand new experience. But we need to package our prescriptions and move them into the right places in public policy so that they are ready to change the marketplace as it reawakens. Now, it's good we have ways of doing more than one thing and contributing countermeasures to more than one of the convergent emergencies at a time, and sometimes all four, because there will not be enough money. There will not be enough money to solve any of them individually. There just won't. And by the way, since you have the talent of being able to do that, to spend some of the private and public money one time but solve four things at once, you are hereby declared to be indispensable. Congratulations. So that's what makes you indispensable. Now, there is agreement, general agreement, that in order to deal with these things, the agreement between ourselves and a lot of the different do-gooder groups that we call our friends, that more compact, complete, and connected settlements are profoundly better in their performance, especially their environmental performance. We need to build more densely, more intensely, and in better connected ways. And we need to do this using the lost space in settlements that we've already started most of the time in order to do so. The difference between us and our colleagues is that the new urbanists don't just say, build more densely, and let it go at that. You know, good luck with that, by the way. Just build more densely. We show specifically how to do it. We draw pictures, and we measure things, and we take what we learn from those measurements, and we embed them into tools, software tools. We don't say, you need a tool. We work up the tool you need and turn it in and say, use this. So we show specifically how to do it in a designed way that'll be more livable and more attractive and more marketable and more fun and more recyclable. The new urbanists look at the places that exist and they say, there's another way. And design is what we use to do it. Design is our advantage. Design is our killer application, or one of two. We say, what if? You know, we look at the places that are partly done, that have the initial tent camp stage of development on them, and we say, that's not finished. That could be something else. We look at it and imagine the place that should be there before. The new urbanists are the people who visualize change before it occurs. Now, the present economic problems, all the turbulence out there, especially the real estate downturn in particular, is at least a reflection of a couple of those emergencies I talked about, and probably not just just the peak of it, but a prelude to it. As Jim Kunstler has told us many times, there are settlement patterns which didn't seem right to us as urbanists, but looked perfectly normal to most everybody else. When huge numbers of Ozzie and Harriet households were being formed, and traffic was relatively free-flowing, and light sweet crude was at $10 or $15 a barrel. But these same patterns seem universally questionable now, since none of those same conditions still exist, and will seem utterly unthinkable at $250 a barrel for light sweet crude oil, or $400 or $600 a barrel. Most recently, in the most advanced state of its corruption, the sprawl settlements were coupled with and kept going by a pretty absurd system of financing debt. The things we criticized for their physical and spatial flaws and their livability failures were, in fact, make-believe financial propositions as well. Now, this slide right here is a picture that John Norquist has showed many times in the lead-in to why he thinks lead-in D is a good idea. LEED for Neighborhood Developments was created in part as a reaction to LEED for New Construction, which tended to add up your performance on certain prerequisites and credits, give you a score. And if you had enough of these things, like enough compact fluorescent light bulbs and enough great insulation and so on, you could be certified or certified gold, like this building, an office building out in the middle of nowhere, which was occupied by a bunch of workers who were located 20 miles closer into the metropolitan center in Chicago area before they were relocated to that box. And that was a LEED gold certified building. Now, what does it have to do with the financial thing? Well, it turns out that what they did inside the building that John hated so much was this was the headquarters of the HSBC subprime mortgage operations. And I say was because they shut it down a couple of weeks ago. Jim Kunstler wrote this week about this same thing. Driving an extra 20 miles, how big a deal could that be, right? Another consequence of the debt problem is that we won't be able to maintain the network of gold-plated highways, he wrote, and lesser roads as well, that was necessary as the cars themselves to make the whole motoring system work. The trouble is you just have to keep gold-plating it year after year. We can't afford to do it anymore. Now, I want to examine quickly these four things and a perspective about each of them. First, on the climate. Confirmation. We're past the stage where people have to get into long debates about whether climate change is real. There seems to be a great deal of emerging consensus about this now. Why am I particularly concerned about this? It matters for all of us, but let me tell you, if you live in South Florida, it matters more. As the water will begin puddling up around our ankles, our friend Hal Wanless at the University of Miami pointed out to us that despite all the discussion about what the world would look like with 3 to 5 feet of sea level rise in the next 50 to 80 years, the problem is that the ocean is a great big heat engine. And once we heat it up, it will not cool down quickly. It will cool down, if ever, very slowly. So we actually have to be very concerned now with how it happens in the next 10 to 15 years, not just about the 3 to 5 feet in the next 50 years, because that's 3 to 5 feet on the way to some other big, higher, deeper number. And it will keep going. So actually what we do right now will make a big difference on the issue of climate change. Now, how do we do this? Smart growthers have this part right. We have to build more densely. And look what the evidence shows. As the density goes up, the carbon footprint goes down. It goes down a lot. Here's just one example from the Pacific Northwest. Guess what? When we connect the streets and things that are otherwise disconnected, the carbon footprint also goes down. Let me ask you, if you see those two charts together, why not do both? Please don't say, let's just build more densely. Say, let's build more densely along a pattern of really great streets. And then third, what if we mix the uses? When we bring neighborhood retail into close proximity with the places where people work and live, what happens? The carbon footprint drops again. So let's not just build more densely and better connected. Let's build more densely, more mixed and better connected. Now, the New Urbanists are students of history. We care about precedent. And the New Urbanists can look at the history of city building. 3 or 5,000 years of human experience tells us how to do it. And guess what? People have been doing those things, denser, more connected, more mixed-use places, very artfully for a long time. We can measure them. And they were being done recently. This is a 20th century settlement. Remember that century? Not very long ago? 20th century settlement called Forest Hills Gardens. Done very artfully, despite its dense. We know how to do this stuff because we study history. Or at least we should. In the LEED for Neighborhood Development's battle, early on, we proposed a thing called a credit for the study and application of regional and historical precedents in urbanism and architecture. It was quickly squelched by the group who said, oh, that's going to be too easy a credit to earn. Besides, nobody, they should do that anyway. They all do it, don't they? Well, they don't. It was squelched by some of our own members from CNU. I think it was the West Coast people. I'm just guessing. Who said, history is bunk. We don't care about that. They had canceled history classes by the time we got to architecture school. So we don't have that as a credit and lead for neighborhood developments, but I hope you will do it. Because if we're building in the center of the big cities, history shows us that we can make them connected and denser and more livable in the process. If we study the small towns, we see the same thing. We know how to do it on the opposite, on all the ends of the spectrum. We know how to do it in new development. It's been proven by our members. The new urbanists know how to do that. Now, I know I left my transect around here somewhere. Just had to say it. Now, there's this big, big world out there of all the ways we can build. And it includes building the bad old sprawl way. And it includes a universe of things that meet our charter and its 27 principles for the new urbanism. And we would all look at that and say, yeah, that's new urbanism. We've got a great big tent and a great big bandwidth of what we include. And what you're going to have to accept, I think, at least initially, with the LEED 2009 version of LEED for Neighborhood Developments, is that that tool will not get all of it. It will probably get part of it and leave some of it out. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be enthusiastic about getting, for the first time, the credibility that comes from a very carefully set up method for certifying the environmental and energy, in particular, credentials of your proposals. You should get it. Now, several of us on the CNU board and others have worked with the Natural Resources Defense Council, Sierra Club, Smart Growth Groups, and the U.S. Green Building Council and others in a loose confederation of warring factions, otherwise known as the Partnership, okay, on getting this to be set up. And we don't have in this system and its draft everything that should be there. And there are things that are in there in compromised form or wrong. And these will be fixed over time. But what we do need to do is get it out there and get it working and demonstrate through real projects where the flaws remain and how they should be polished out. If our members in CNU will get an opportunity this summer to do something they've never been asked to do before at all. They'll be given a ballot. Not just to the executive committee or the chair or the board, but to the membership. They'll be given a ballot and asked, vote, do you think we ought to put the imprimatur of our organization on this thing called LEED and D? And when they do, it'll go live and it'll be available for people to use. And we will learn a lot from using it together. And in August or September or so, work to refine it and adjust it to create LEED and D 2011 will begin. So I encourage you to participate in this. If you haven't done so, go to the website, which you can easily access through CNU, and participate in something called the Second Public Comment. That ends on Sunday. You brought your laptop. You can do it from here. There's Wi-Fi in the lobby. And then when the opportunity presents itself for the final draft that'll incorporate results from those public comments, vote to include LEED and D in our toolkit. Climate at CNU is much bigger than LEED and D. In fact, it is blossoming into a two-pronged important program that will include a new manual and curriculum on how to help local governments, community groups, and developers lower the carbon footprint through good design. Okay, and it will include a campaign, a public relations campaign or an educational campaign to explain why it is we think we have that convenient remedy. So corner Robin Rather, who's here tonight, sometime during this weekend. He's working on that campaign. Corner Dan Parolik and Joe DiStefano and others who volunteered with their voices on the climate campaign and give them your ideas on how that should be shaped. Now, the others I can cover quickly to get the general idea. The second one is peak oil. There's no question. We're not going to run all the way out. It's just going to cost so much more to pull the next barrel out than it cost to pull the last barrel out, that eventually the prospect will turn to be unaffordable. And while the different models suggest that the peak has either already occurred or is occurring this year or occurs 2 years from now or 10 years from now, there's general agreement that we're almost there. So peak oil is not a debatable idea. It's here. What are we going to do about it? Well, one of the things we have to do is actually adjust our idea of what the highest standard of living is. Doesn't mean the personal car for every single person driven as many miles as you can possibly drive it. It probably means making places out of the car-dependent places that were there before. What do the new urbanists have? We know how to do that artfully. What about public health? Our children aren't walking. They aren't moving about. They aren't moving burning the calories, as the video said at the beginning. It completely corresponds. The growth in overweight, that's just Matt Kogan's diagram, over here on the right, precisely corresponds with the growth in vehicle miles of travel per household. This is an undisputable idea. How are we going to fix it? We have to make settlements where it's a natural thing to walk from here to there to get some of your basic daily needs accomplished. And we have to have free-range children, not captured ones. Last, the big wave. This is Todd and Laurie's diagram that shows the great numbers of people who, in the blue color, will be turning 50 to 59 during the years in this timeline. This is the baby boom generation, the demographic pig in a python we've heard about all our lives, moving through the world, through time, changing everything in its path, changing buying habits, changing preferences, changing needs. In the gray bars are the millennials, those aged in any given year 20 to 29, and look at the numbers of them rising rapidly, the children of the boomers who are coming back from college, that young pharmacist who needs housing but can't afford it in the neighborhood they grew up in, that young pharmacist's parents who are empty nesters and need a completely different habitat from the one for which they invested their life savings a few decades ago. So what do they need? They need a massively different kind of way to build. Well, as we age, we have other things we need. This smiling, happy person appeared at the grand opening in Glenwood Park a few years ago. "Welcome, if not disabled," said her balloon. And that day, just like at CNU in New York, the folks who speak for those with physical challenges took the new urbanists to task and said, "You're not building the habitat that we need unless you're taking us into account." Now, build more densely and build housing and workplace options for people who don't want to maintain the large house on the large lot in the distant exurbs. That means we're going to have to remember how to do it artfully. Monument Avenue in Richmond is a great example. Now, I don't mean to be glib about the new urbanism's shot at successfully navigating the great pause, or it's a real risk, even if you're convinced that we're just experiencing just that, a pause, and not the beginnings of Grim Jim's long emergency. I hope it's just a pause, Jim. But there's real risk to any movement at a time like this, and so a final thought or two about that. The Plan of Chicago by Daniel Burnham, you might think of that 1909 as a high point in American city planning history, was drawn up just 20 years before the start of the Great Depression in 1929. Ray Gendros has pointed out that many of the great practitioners we admire from the first quarter of the 20th century, the practice of Burnham, the practice of the Olmsted brothers, the John Nolans, whom we memorialize in our medal, the Albert Peets, who wrote Civic Art, all their colleagues, they were dead or forgotten or out of business or mothballed into some dim corners of their universities by the time the market kicked back in and building began again. And their movements were essentially halted. The public mind and the attention of the building arts was captured by other things, things very imaginatively drawn. The giant, unbreakable glass, plastic, atomic-powered city of the future was one of them. Yep, this is the image from yesterday's Tomorrow's. And, you know, that they presided, using this new idea, they presided over the greatest building boom in human history, and the sprawl experiment we all criticized was just that, an experimented, implemented on a continent-wide and on a global basis without a field test. Without a field test. And after the Depression and the war, it took 30 years for O'Grady Clay, sitting here on the front row, to declare that, in print, that another way was coming. A way of the new urbanists. And it took 50 years for there to be seaside. It took 80 years after the start of the Great Depression until we were just now beginning to get a critical mass of built new urbanism, or just beginning to see the real potential importance of our charter. The leading planning professionals of the 1920s lacked, not for lack of trying, but they lacked an organization like this one, which is the reason why you should work every day for the next 365 to keep CNU vital. They lacked an organization that was tightly networked like ours, that would teach each other how to do what we do, that would nurture its young, most importantly, and that would advocate forcefully for the right national, state, and local policies. We'll work details out with one another, in squabbles if necessary, and then leverage the power of the teamwork and the solidarity. I'm saying to you, stay with this. Steady as she goes. We'll come out on the other side of the perfect storm. Can we sustain our movement? Think back about this happy, smiling people, Joe Cole and all his friends. Here he is, standing on the porch in Alexandria at CNU1. Joe and I were the youngest ones in the picture, I'll have you know. These people, actually, our teachers who were surrounding us on that porch that day showed us things. They said, here's how you do it. Here are the old documents we've found so far. Now you find some more. We showed each other. The New Urbanism wasn't a Pythagorean secret society. Okay? It was about showing each other what we do. Do I think that we can sustain our momentum and reach the other side of the great pause? As the phrase of the year says, yes, we can. Yes, we can. And we must. The students for the New Urbanism immediately did an irreverent send-up of that photograph, posing. I like the one here, the flower print shirt with the guy in the beard dressed as Liz Mool, and then, just Jacob Lindsay and his friends. They said, we'll do it. We'll carry this movement on to the other side. So I'm calling you to agreement on the most important of the enterprises, the agreement on environment as priority one. I'm asking you to think that despite the rhetoric we use on the listserv to fire each other up and say, get out there and argue for the best thing, that for one thing, declaring a blanket war on all environmentalists and all environmental regulations is not the way to go. But we need to work with these groups, even in the warring factions. And I'll say to you that there is precedent even for making our way through a very grim and scary time. In a moment of great peril, the brain trusters did this. And the New Deal funded roads, of course. They built 600 plus thousand miles of road. They built bridges, big soaring ones and little, small, elegant ones. They funded parks and monuments, which were meant to be civic art. They funded civic buildings, lots of them, thousands of them. They funded the arts, and yes, the New Deal funded planning. Some of it good, some of it not so good, but the New Deal said planning is stimulus. We can do that too. But if we do it, we should do it with artfulness. That's the role of the Congress, to teach each other that. Now is our moment. Show each other how to do what you do. Quickly, before the water gets up around my ankles in Miami. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. Thank you.